Join us for a very special program as we bring you the best audio documentaries of the year, the winners of the 2020 Third Coast Competition. Chosen from more than 700 entries, the 11 winners are beautifully crafted original stories from around the world. Come celebrate audio storytelling at its finest with Best of the Best from the Third Coast Festival.
Best of the Best, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to continue a discussion we started yesterday with Tony Clark. He's a former commissioner for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, former chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. But we were talking about the grid. And of course, we typically think about the grid as a place that passes generated energy from a big plant somewhere to our home light switch. But there are other ways to look at it, too. And one of the ways to look at it is from John Bagieu. He's a former professor at NDSU. He's now the president of Community Electrification. And we're going to talk about solar energy with John. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on your program. Again, I think it was on years ago, so it's nice to revisit you again.
Yes, it's been a while. I remember we touched base with you about the time you were electrifying your house with solar panels, and we're going to follow up and chat about that. But first of all, what is Community Electrification? It's the name of your business. Describe it for us.
It's a local Fargo company, and I started it a couple years ago because really we needed to have some company in Fargo and more capable of doing projects in Moorhead too, which looks at putting solar panels on people's houses, but also looks at EV charge stations, especially the DC fast EV charge stations. And I also like to look at replacing lights with LED lights to save a boatload of money over time. And to be honest, I have done all three of those things myself at my place. So I'm selling stuff that I personally have used for up to a decade now, including solar panels and LED light bulbs. And when it comes to saving money, let me put it to you this way. I have a 2,700 square foot house. I have an EV vehicle. I spend $100 on energy, direct energy costs between the months of February and October in Fargo. That's $11 a month to power both my house and car combined. So I'm quite happy with the results, and I'd like to have those results with other people in North Dakota and in Western Minnesota too.
I can vouch for LED lights. I changed mine over a few years back, and that made a big difference to my monthly bottom line.
Oh, yeah.
My son drives an EV. John, what got you started with solar power?
It's really, I think it goes back to my environmental kind of upbringing. I always like to go camping in the mountains of Canada. I'm a Canadian. And I wanted to leave the smallest footprint possible, you know, the smallest amount of garbage possible during my life on the planet Earth. So if an alien came by, you know, 100 years later and looked at the pollution levels of the planet, I could say to that alien, well, I didn't contribute as much as everybody else. I kind of did my share to reduce my pollution content. So don't judge me like you can judge the rest of the species that way. So in a sense, I really like the planet we have. I like to keep it as close as I can to the way it was. And we are just doing a crappy job of managing it. So I want to try and fix our problems as much as I can personally.
So how long ago did you decide I'm going to put solar panels on my house?
That was really within a year or two of buying my first house in the United States. So it was quite immediate. Another contributing factor was my wife and I had our only daughter, Mira. We named after a binary star system. So, you know, it was like that really drove home what I grew up with is like I am passing this planet on to my daughter, and I do want her to have a better life than me when it comes to breathing, health, and just a higher quality of living for a longer period of time.
Well, let's get some nuts and bolts here. When did you install this system? Was it difficult to install, and how much did it cost?
Oh, boy, you really want to get into the weeds. Well, I'm the person to take you to the weeds. So I installed my solar panel system about, I would say, 9 years ago, back in 2012. So we're coming up to the 10th anniversary. I've been monitoring production every day since then. So I can tell you what I produced 8 years ago. I can look at the calendar or look at my data sheet and tell you exactly how much energy I got that day. It cost me about $35,000, and then I got a 30% tax credit, that federal credit. That's the only tax credit I got worth mentioning in my life. That's not standard. So whoopee, you know, I felt so impressive doing that. It was like, wow, I finally got a tax credit that wasn't normal. Isn't that great? So I actually liked the tax credit because in a sense, I spent the money to get it. And I forced the federal government to use that money to put panels on my house, which I think is a great way to spend tax dollars. So I really like the idea of forcing the federal government to spend your own tax dollars in the way that you want them to. Man, we were living a different world if that was the case. And so, but it was difficult. We had to get a company. It was a local company, built it a great job. But we had to get somebody from Minnesota to install it. And, you know, and boy, things have changed. So now when I sell people's panels to them, like we had a few houses in Fargo and Moorhead recently, the last couple of years, basically I sell them systems that are half the price and almost produce on a monthly basis the same amount of energy I get. And they're like two thirds the size. So solar panels have come a long way in the last decade in terms of the price going down and in terms of how much production you get, how efficient they become. And so I'm quite pleased to say, boy, I got kind of a lousy deal compared to what my customers are now getting, and I'm happy for them.
Prairie Public News reporter Danielle Webster talked with you recently, and in her story, you said that you bought a Cadillac system years ago when a Toyota system would have served you better. How good is the technology now?
Yeah, it really has improved in terms of overall efficiency, the panels. So my panels are roughly the same size as the panels, the 320-watt panels I'm selling or 315-watt panels I'm selling, but my panels are 245 watts. So just on the same area, the same size panels, instead of getting 245 watts about 10 years ago, those panels are now producing 315, 320 watts. So that's 60, 70, 80 watts improvement right there. The microinverters now are highly efficient. And I've because of COVID, and I said this to Danielle too, I've actually had a change of mind basically. So I've watched this last year as 500,000 people have died in this country. I've seen the political instability. I've now seen the grid instability. And it's like, I now recommend batteries to people. You know, if you want, when I first started, the big thing about solar was, oh, it's expensive to begin with. So why would you want to spend $7,000 to $10,000 adding batteries? Well, now after this last year, maybe adding that price to it isn't such a bad idea, just having that safety net, because I don't see that safety net in other places where I thought it was.
Well, when we put shingles on our roofs, we expect them to last 20 or 30 years. How long should a solar panel last?
30 years. Yeah, mine's supposed to last 25 years. The ones I saw are rated for 30 years. And so my system, in the first 10 years, most of those years, the energy actually went up. And it a lot depends on how much clouds are in the skies. But basically, normally it's 9,500 kilowatt hours a year of DC production, and my overall production is usually plus or minus 5% every year. So it's pretty consistent.
Now, solar panels are the elements that are visible outside to somebody walking by your house, but you've mentioned a couple of other things. What else do you need inside? You've mentioned maybe batteries. You're getting DC power from the panel, so you need an inverter.
But the great thing about the new systems are if you do go with no batteries and just use the microinverters, they fit underneath the panels now. So all this noise that is in my basement that comes from the charge controllers and my 8-kilowatt inverter, which is a central inverter, pretty impressive piece of equipment, but it makes noise when it's inverting. The charge controllers whine when they're converting the energy and changing the voltage so it's right for my batteries. Now everything's on the outside. So all you do is basically run it through the solar panels. It goes to the microinverters, which converts it to AC. And then it goes, you know, all that stuff is done outside. No noise inside. Run a wire into your circuit box and you're ready to go.
John Bagu is president of Community Electrification, and he's living the example that he wants to set for people. That is, his home has solar energy. Do you install this and forget it, or does it require more attention than our present power system? You know, I just flip a switch on now.
That's a great point. You can pretty much forget it. Like if you're a data junkie like me, you track it every day or every week or every month just to see how you're doing. But there's no moving parts in solar. Most solar applications have no moving parts. So there's very little maintenance. The only problem I've had in my first 10 years, and this is what we do now with my new customers, is that we put anti-corrosion fluid in the connections, because one of my connections for three of my 30 panels went down because of corrosion and my circuit boxes were full of water after 7-8 years. So really, keeping corrosion out of the wire connections is, you know, Fargo has tough weather. We get everything, rain, snow, wind, hail, you betcha we get it. And because of that, now all my new customers, we put the anti-corrosion fluid in to begin with so that they won't have to worry about that so much.
You gave a TEDx Bismarck address years ago where you talked about your transition from academic life to becoming a proponent for solar power, and in that matter, basically creating a business to install it. Did your example spur others? You said you've been doing some installations. Is this catching on?
It slowly is, but there are many factors in our area, specifically North Dakota, which prevent this. So, for example, the local utilities in Fargo offer some of the lowest rates in the nation. And North Dakota overall, when it comes to solar and EV use, we are last in the nation. So if you like being the worst at something, we are it in North Dakota. And unfortunately, we are missing out. I just actually wrote a kind of letter supporting the recent Senate Bill 2295, going kind of net metering, where, you know, if you want our state to, solar has more, so if you want to talk about jobs, solar is very job intensive. I work with local companies like RBB Electric, MJ Dulson Roofing. I even work with the drone company with Joey. And so it's a very, it's a collaboration of four local companies, because I actually don't have employees myself. I'm a one-person company, but I work with other local companies who are experts, licensed and bonded in North Dakota and Minnesota. And now we've done these projects, EV charge stations, solar projects in Fargo and across the state, EV charge stations across the state. And, you know, we just, our state just doesn't promote these new technologies, and we are losing out on jobs. We are losing out on local energy. I mean, when people come to me, and I just had an example of it on Friday, and a person, Eric in Fargo, wants to put panels on this house. And then I tell them, well, you're with this utility. This utility pays you 2.8 cents a kilowatt hour out of 11 cents if your energy touches the grid. So you lose 75% of its value. And what do people respond then? What's their reaction? Well, I'm not so sure I want to do this anymore. And I, to be honest, I have a really big problem selling panels in North Dakota and in Fargo when they get 2.4 or 2.8 cents a kilowatt hour. And then when I sell it in Moorhead, those people with the exact same system for most of their energy get 11 cents a kilowatt hour. It just is kind of a, well, it's just, you know, it puts a damper on enthusiasm. And, you know, all 90% of the people, some people still do it. They don't care about the loss of economic value because you touch the grid. And I can go into the details of it, you know, of how they're double charging fees and blah, blah, blah. But it's just, I mean, just up front, if you lose 75% of something that you've completely invested in, and some entity comes along who didn't invest a cent in the project, gets 75% of the value, nobody's going to want to really do that, would you?
Yeah, that is a difficult incentive to rationalize.
I really have problems selling these kind of solar systems in Fargo because I know they're not getting a good deal. We're last place in the nation. There's a reason why we're last place in the nation. And I've asked them voluntarily, one cooperative, to change. I haven't gone to Excel yet to ask them voluntarily do that. But pretty much I got told, nah, not going to happen. And I don't know if the Senate bill is going to pass this year, but if it goes by previous years, I don't think it's even going to get recommended by committee. So as long as we give the worst rates in the nation for solar energy and not promote local energy, we are just going nowhere, basically.
Well, the Cass County Electric Co-op put together a solar farm project a couple of years ago, and I don't think they got much response. Is that why? Did you just explain why?
Yeah, they I don't want to be too critical of people too much. You know, there were issues with it, and I would also say, just based on their reaction, I'm never going to add another panel again. And they were doing it to collect data to prove how bad solar was. So if your initiative isn't really supporting it to begin with, but you have longer term implications for it, then no, it's not going to succeed. How could it? They also limited people initially to only purchase 2 panels. I wanted 10 to power my electric vehicle. I could only get 2 at the time, so why bother? So yeah, there were issues with that.
You mentioned net metering, and I want to get into that a bit because it does turn the distribution system sort of on its head. You've got currently we have a generator and the power lines, and it comes to our house. And what we're talking about here is that every home could conceivably be a generator and feed the network. So what is the current availability of that where we live?
Well, like I say, you can connect to the grid, but you will lose a lot of the value if your energy touches the grid, which is why I recommend batteries, especially to people in Fargo and North Dakota, too, because if you store the energy yourself and it doesn't touch the grid, then you get the full 10 or 11 cents a kilowatt hour that you're paying for it. So basically, yeah, you can do these projects. They're nice enough to let you attach to their grids, but they just give you the worst rates in the nation for economic value. So if you're doing this for economics, it makes it really hard to justify. Just as an example, I had a project last year, a potential project before COVID came along, where someone was willing to donate $60,000 to put solar panels on the YWCA women's shelter in Fargo, which sounds great. You know, that's a great gift. It's a wonderful gift. And if you think about it, that $60,000 worth of solar panels over the 30-year lifetime of the system is going to generate $120,000 worth of energy. So you're actually donating double what you initially gave with the energy produced. But because of the way the local utilities price their energy, if it touches the grid, it ends up roughly, depending how much the YWCA would have used, that they would have only got the $60,000 back over 30 years time, and the utility would have got $60,000 out of that donation for basically doing nothing. So if that sounds fair to you, then you can be happy with the way things are done. But that doesn't sound fair to me, that, you know, when you do all the work, install your own system, you lose roughly half the value to the utility. And, you know, and plus you're paying a monthly charge as well for fees too. So let's be honest, it's not just they're collecting fees off the direct energy. They're collecting fees from you on a monthly basis as well. How many times do you want us to pay a fee?
Is our current grid system a barrier to community-generated power? Does it need to be strengthened?
No, actually, I've been operating with their grid for 10 years, and there's been no issue whatsoever. So there's no actual barriers. In fact, I would say local energy is the best energy, because when I produce it, it comes out at the right voltage for the grid. It comes out at the right frequency for the grid, and it doesn't go through the transmission process. So most of our energy comes from coal plants in Grand Forks or wind farms or hydro plants. It depends on where they get it. It comes from hundreds of miles away or 100 miles away, potentially. You have to take that energy, go through the process of transporting it to Fargo. It gets upscaled to voltages of over probably 100,000 volts. Then you have to bring it down to eventually the right voltage that we use, and then you can distribute it. So actually, local energy completely bypasses that expensive transmission process. So we're actually cheaper. We're more reliable because, hey, there's no transmission line breaks or transmission problems. We are already grid ready to go. We just go straight to our neighbors. My energy probably never leaves my block because somebody's using it at the time during the day. And it's just the most efficient, cheapest, best form of energy. So yeah, we're actually helping. In fact, the last with the way the grid problems in the last winter time cold period, like last week I looked at my data, the coldest days were Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, roughly. I was producing roughly 40 kilowatt hours of solar energy on those days every day, and my average is 26 kilowatt hours. So I was producing 50% above average on the coldest days last week, And my house uses about 20 kilowatt hours of day energy a day. So I was producing almost enough energy for two houses during that difficult time. And the week before that, I was, again, above average production every day of the week. So we actually helped the grid out during times when our production's great and we're not affected by cold. I have never seen my solar panels freeze. They operate on Mars. They operate in outer space. Solar does. They don't freeze. If you get snow on them, that's a problem. No energy system is perfect. Let's face it. But the one thing I also want to say is basically, if you mentioned my TEDx Bismarck experience, and that was an interesting talk because I wanted to give a presentation that was comparing fossil fuels to a dragon that goes around killing people. And the people in Bismarck kindly said, "Nah, don't say that in Bismarck. It's not going to go down well." And they were probably right, but I kind of wish I still would have given it. Instead, I called it a ritual human sacrifice. And I just was, and this is what I wanted to say to people who've been complaining about renewable energy not working in Texas or in cold temperatures. I want to ask them one question. How many people, millions of people a year, are you okay with dying because of fossil fuel pollution? And so over the years, I've given lectures at Concordia on COVID's changed that, but up to COVID years, I've given two or more lectures every year at Concordia. And I point out to students that according to the World Health Organization, 7 million people a year die from air pollution, 3.5 million outdoor, 3.5 million indoor. Well, there's a new study that came out 2 weeks ago. And that outdoor air pollution number caused by fossil fuels is now 8.7 million, which is 1 out of 5 deaths every year. And I looked at that study, and I think it's actually more because they didn't include like mercury emissions from coal plants and benzene and toluene from car vehicle exhaust emissions. So I asked the people who are trashing renewable energy, how many millions of people a year are you okay with dying? Is it 3.5 million, like the WHO study said? Is it 8.7 million, like the Harvard study said, or is it more like I think because they didn't include other factors as well? And so I really think if you think about that, we really shouldn't be trashing renewable energy. Sure, every form of energy has its problems. There's ways to compensate it. And I would say let's try energy storage at a local level to make the grid even more reliable. So what we do is for the benefit of humanity. It gets back to why I did this at the beginning, to make the world a better place.
Elon Musk and others have been making headlines with cars, home batteries, solar panels, and even shingles. What innovations are you anticipating?
I think the biggest one is really putting it all together, like having EV with solar and wind and batteries and storage. It's really the part of my company that I like is I just don't focus on one technology. And so Elon Musk, one of the smartest things he did, and you can question his sanity sometimes, legitimately, but one of the smartest things he did was when he bought his solar company and really combined EV with solar. You don't hear much about Tesla solar component, and yet most of their business is the solar component, not the EV component. So I think all these technologies are coming together. We should have had energy storage on the grid, 30, 40 years ago. It doesn't matter what kilowatt hour is being produced. We should have some storage, and it should all be in local areas where the energy is used. I'd like to call Texas, what happened in Texas, the Texas grid, the Monty Python grid. And I was wanting to start a kind of internet campaign to rename Texas Grid as Monty Python Grid. But I like Monty Python so much, I don't think I want to do it to those guys.
John Bagieu is the president of Community Electrification. And John, thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate being on your program.
Coming up on Main Street, a Conversations About Healthcare podcast about gaps in health equity and public health preparedness. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state Senate has reached its crossover break. That happens when the Senate has finished its bills and sent the bills that still survive over to the House. Senators are now on break until next Wednesday. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson told the Senate it's akin to finishing the first period of a hockey game. He says when senators return, that's the second period, and the conference committees are the third period. Wardner says this year, the leaders want to finish the 80-day session with days to spare.
We would like to get out of here so that we have at least 6, 7, 8 days left on the calendar, because we do have a reapportionment session coming up later this year. So we're going to be pushing, and when we say pushing, we mean putting in more hours in committee. I don't want you to do haphazard work on the bills. I want you to put more time in. You may have to come back after session so that we can get this thing wrapped up.
The House is still in session and expects to be so until Thursday. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is proposing a $518 million bonding bill for infrastructure projects. Repair and maintenance of college buildings is a big part of that plan. Democrats will need the support of House Republicans to pass any bonding bill. Republican House Minority Leader Kurt Dowd says he is willing to discuss a proposal as long as it is small.
It depends on the projects. If there are projects that are necessary that should be worked on, you know, we're certainly open to it. We traditionally do in a non-binding year, we traditionally do a smaller bonding bill, something in the, you know, $100, $150 million range.
Minnesota lawmakers passed a nearly $2 billion bonding bill last year. And the House has passed a measure to levy taxes on recreational marijuana. It taxes both the manufacturing and the sale of the weed, and it would take effect if the recreational marijuana measure becomes law. The measure levies a 15% tax for all gross receipts at the dispensaries. Manufacturing facilities would be taxed at 10%. Montpelier Republican Representative Craig Hedlund chairs the House Finance and Taxation Committee.
We know that prohibition hasn't worked. We know that there's a lot of North Dakota citizens using black market marijuana today. We also know that there are problems associated with that. This is going to provide us a revenue stream that'll help us deal with some of the impacts of recreational use of adult marijuana.
The bill passed 73-21. It will now be considered in the Senate. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Dave Thompson. This week's Legislative Review guest will be Republican Senator Brad Beckedahl of Williston. We'll talk about what's been accomplished thus far, what the main issues and sticking points will be after crossover, and about bills specifically for northwestern North Dakota and the oil patch. Legislative Review airs at 6:30 p.m. Central Time on our radio service and anytime on our digital platforms.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we'll share a conversation about healthcare podcast that focused on holes in healthcare equity and public health readiness. Hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter spoke with Dr. Craig Spencer, an emergency medicine and epidemiology expert on the board of Doctors Without Borders.
Dr. Spencer, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you for the invitation and thank you for having me.
Yeah, and you know, we're so moved by your writing and the work that you've done. Obviously, you've delivered healthcare all around the world in war zones that have been devastated by epidemics. And it's been a year since you started sharing your really human dispatches from inside New York's emergency rooms as the pandemic unfolded, which was, I think, fair to say, its own type of war zone. I'm wondering if you can just share with our listeners what you're seeing now. How does it compare to those early days of the pandemic?
That's a great question. It's really nothing compares to the early days of the pandemic. You noted that I had worked in West Africa. I'd worked in the middle of civil conflict in Burundi. I've worked in some pretty tough places, and very few have actually taken my breath away, like walking into the emergency room in early April of 2020 and walking into what felt like the apocalypse.
Yeah.
I had more people die on a daily basis in New York City from COVID than I did in West Africa from Ebola at many points. And you know, the one thing that really stuck out to me this morning, I was listening to a report on NPR about a young emergency medicine doctor, a colleague out in LA, who had taken all these photos and tried to show the humanity of what was happening inside their emergency rooms there, facing similar situations to what we were facing almost a year ago. Mm-hmm. And it was heartening in a sense to know that my colleagues understand the difficulty of this, the challenge of this, and that in some sense, we're together in this crisis in unison and that we're sharing this experience. I think that's important for our mental health and for healing afterwards. But at the same time, I was really dejected because, as you said, it's been nearly a year that I started sharing, you know, the reality of COVID, what it means inside hospitals. And here I have colleagues of mine across the country that are really starting, or, you know, really having to deal with this really hard on a daily basis, still in the same way that it was hitting us, you know, almost a year ago. So in that sense, the fact that it has been going on so long, that it was so acute, that it was so hard, it just made us all exhausted in a way that, quite frankly, I haven't been in a long time. Now, in New York City, we still have a high rate of COVID. If you look at the map, you know, we're still considered a severe outbreak, but it's very different than when it was in March and April, when every single patient coming in was short of breath, had a low oxygen, many needed, you know, immediate resuscitation, many people died. We're still seeing COVID, but we're much better at managing it. And I think we're much better at managing ourselves as well.
Well, Dr. Spencer, it feels like the whole world's been in a state of being overwhelmed by the COVID-19 pandemic for a whole year now. And we remember back before that when we were all concerned about Ebola. And now I understand Ebola has recently reemerged in Africa, eliciting tremendous concern in the global health community. And of course, you have the direct experience of having both cared for Ebola patients and having become very sick yourself with that. But you've said that your experience with Ebola did much to prepare you for our current experiences with COVID-19. I'd be really interested to hear, what lessons did you bring back from that experience of battling a deadly pathogen in a place where so little was known at the time, and there were so few healthcare resources?
Yeah, that's a great question. There were, you know, practical things that I had learned, but also some more important, I think, coping strategies that I had learned from working in places like West Africa during Ebola. From a practical perspective, you know, in the US, we don't have to use personal protective equipment, or didn't really, all that often and all that well, right? We didn't have, and unless you were working primarily with TB patients, tuberculosis patients, or others with concerning infectious diseases, we didn't put on N95s all that often, the majority of us. We didn't have to really worry about the integrity of our personal protective equipment, because we weren't worried that every patient could potentially have a very deadly disease that could impact us and our families. And I think having had that experience in West Africa, putting on an N95 multiple times a day, you know, going through the donning and doffing process, recognizing that doffing is way more important than actual donning, that's where you're potentially infected, knowing that having a PPE buddy, someone to check on you and really to make sure your personal protective equipment is put on correctly and remains protective throughout your shift. These are all really important things that I learned from others working in West Africa that I tried to implement here in New York City when we were dealing with COVID. But I think the more important lessons that I learned, and I think more important for myself and for my colleagues, was that doing this work isn't just physically exhausting, it's mentally exhausting. And at the beginning, I think there's a lot of motivation. This is challenging. I work in an emergency room where, you know, quite frankly, we love taking care of whatever comes through, is coming through the doors. And the bigger the challenge, the better. But after a couple of weeks of this, of seeing so many of your patients struggle to breathe, so many die, and really feeling helpless in a way, it was both morally dejecting and from a mental health perspective, I saw it starting to take a big toll. And I had gone through this before in West Africa. I'd learned some of those coping mechanisms. What do you do when not only your patients are getting sick, but some of your friends and your colleagues are as well? And so trying to create a space for my colleagues to be vulnerable, to share. You know, in medicine, we're not that great with sharing our vulnerabilities. We're not that great with talking about our mental health issues or our challenges. And so I thought really important early on was to make that space for my colleagues, my friends. And I think that helped and made a big difference.
It certainly did. You know, there, I think there's no secret that the United States failed to meet the challenges of the pandemic, from denial to having no unified national testing protocols or any real public health strategies. And you said that we failed at every turn. I think we've heard people say a failure of the public health system seems to be too generous. It almost seemed to be criminal in nature, if you will, because the studies have shown that that if we could have reduced deaths by 40% in the United States if we followed some simple basic public health protocols, which could have been articulated at a national level. This 50-state strategy never seemed to work, and still probably isn't the smartest move. Talk to us about the public health failures that led to the catastrophe, and what we must learn from these really unfortunate, harsh lessons that devastated the lives of so many Americans.
Yeah, I want to say in retrospect, it gets me quite frustrated, but it's not retrospect, right? We're still in the throes of this pandemic, but we can look back on the previous administration and I think reflect on a lot of the early missteps that set us up for really for failure that we continue to see, right? We're having the equivalent of, a 9/11 in terms of deaths every single day in this country. Even as case numbers and hospitalizations numbers go down, deaths are still stubbornly high. Look, I wrote in 2015 in the New England Journal of Medicine, a reflection on my experience with Ebola and how politics had played into the public health response then. And if you recall, there were many governors, including one who was leading the response here in my own home state, who politicized the way that we responded and the public health measures needed to respond to Ebola at that time. And what I said was that, in times of national crisis and national, disease outbreaks and public health emergencies, we need really one unified and codified plan from the CDC, not 50 different ideas that can change with their proximity to the next election. And we've seen that throughout, right? And a lot of this was stoked by an administration that did undermine public health guidance early on, that undermined the value of things like masking and the importance of testing, that made it much more difficult to access some of these critical supplies that were necessary to not only understand the scale and the speed of this pandemic, but to help get it under control. And I think that's reflected in the fact that the US has 4% of the population and over 20% of the cases and the deaths. We did not need to fail this poorly. We did not need to fail this long, and to the point we're now at half a million deaths from COVID and counting. I think it would have been bad here, regardless of who is in charge. This virus itself is mean. We are unfortunately a perfect population for this virus by virtue of being imperfect. We have a lot of chronic diseases. There's an older population. A lot of the things that increase the susceptibility to severe outcomes from COVID. That being said, if we had put in place a strong public health system, not only at the outset of this pandemic, but beforehand, when we knew that a pandemic was coming, and still we underfunded our public health, and pandemic preparedness for so long, we could have prevented a lot of the cases, a lot of the hospitalizations, and a lot of the deaths.
Well, Dr. Spencer, I want to talk about death for a moment. And I know the days when people lined up in the streets in New York and banged their pots and pans in appreciation have faded away. I do think there is a profound and deep ongoing new appreciation for what healthcare workers do when they run towards trouble and not away from it. But the reality was, as you referenced in your opening remarks, healthcare workers were experiencing death at a volume and a rapid and a daily basis that most of us in healthcare have never experienced in our lives. And we've heard from so many people that there seemed to be almost a universal commitment in hospitals to making sure that if people had to die without their loved ones there, they weren't going to die alone. And healthcare workers, all of them, whatever the titles after their name, really did their best to try and bring that end-of-life experience to make it as humane as they could. I know you produced a really powerful video of that experience. Maybe share with our listeners what you all were doing on the inside to try and bring that compassion and presence to people at the end of life.
Yeah, the one thing that I say about what I do, emergency medicine, is that our job is to save lives. Really, that's what we do, whether it's trauma or a heart attack or a stroke or whatever it may be, our job in the emergency department is to save lives and to stabilize. And so many times we found ourselves standing beside a ventilator after speaking with a family, after talking about goals of care, and turning the ventilator off and trying to give some humanity in those last moments of life as those breaths slipped away from someone's father or grandfather or loved one. And it was unlike anything the majority of us had ever done. Even in West Africa, the death from Ebola was horrible and was painful and was difficult to see, but there was something so unnerving and so unexpected about it here in the US. Working in one of the largest hospital systems, having access to anything you could imagine, right, a 24-hour MRI and CAT scan, you know, unlimited resources, for some reason just made this this that much harder to bear. You know, calling up families on the phone, talking to them and trying to explain these end-of-life discussions, likely outcomes over a grainy FaceTime video, was not only really difficult, just technically, it didn't always work so great, but it just was never an easy discussion. It never got easier. It never got better. It was always difficult because on the other end of that video connection was a family or a loved one who was hearing for the first time that their family, their father, their best friend, the person they love the most in this world is likely going to die. And we may have got better at managing the words that we used or thinking about the script or, you know, the training that we actually got as people who are really adept and committed to saving lives. We had to learn about how we talk about what happens at the end of life a lot better. And that was, I think, a challenge for all of us, but especially for us in the emergency department.
But really, those small acts of kindness were so important and made such a profound difference as someone transitioned. You know, there's some good news on the horizon, the vaccines here. And there's a lot to think about, but I really wonder, with this new administration, what's your hope for this new administration? What maybe guidance that you'd like to provide them as they think about the path from here to the next stage and hopefully getting through the rollout of vaccines?
It's a great question. I'll reflect first on how things have gone so far and what I think needs to be a bigger part of the discussion going forward. You know, Ron Klain, who's the White House chief of staff, was the Ebola czar back when I was treating patients in West Africa. And, you know, April of 2020, well, before he had any elected position or any position in the White House, I remember him tweeting out that, you know, getting a vaccine is going to be hard, but getting a vaccine into vials and getting a vaccine out would arguably be even more difficult. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is something that has been on the mind of the people who are now in the Oval Office, who are now overseeing the rollout of this vaccine. And that in itself is heartening. We've seen the numbers over the past few weeks go up. You know, we've doubled the number of vaccines that are being administered now compared to just 4 weeks ago when this administration took over. I think some of that was going to happen regardless. This rocky start and rollout was going to get better regardless of who was in office. But I think that there has been a really coordinated push from the federal government to try to coordinate this much better at the local and state level. And I think that's what we've needed all along, not just with vaccines, but with testing and PPE and treatments, et cetera. I'm quite heartened because really to go from sequencing a genome just over a year ago to having vaccines with over 90% efficacy and getting them into the arms of millions of people is absolutely stunning. And I think a testament to the miracle of science. Mm-hmm. I suspect that, you know, as promised, we will likely have the majority of those eligible in the country vaccinated by this summer. We will have some sense of return of normalcy in the months after that, especially if these vaccines do prove to be as efficacious as the studies have borne out. And that's all great news. The one thing that really concerns me is more around the issues of vaccine equity and what we're going to be doing here in the U.S. to prepare the rest of the world, because it may be cliche, but we're not safe until we're all safe. And that's a big part of the discussion that I haven't seen enough of yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are following the World Health Organization's COVAX efforts and wonder if you can comment on how well you think that is going beyond what we can do here in the United States. How are we doing with this as a global strategy, and how satisfied are you with the efforts to date, and what do you think needs to be done next? Mm-hmm.
What I've been saying is that I personally have received more doses of a COVID vaccine than 130 countries. I'm very lucky, and I'm quite happy that I'm protected, but there are healthcare workers all around the world, like myself and other vulnerable groups, that may not be vaccinated until 2022 or 2023, that may be years away. And the COVAX facility, I think, is great. It is an attempt to try to secure those doses primarily for countries that don't have the ample contracts and purchasing power of advanced economies like our own. It's, I think, a necessary step to make sure that we get the world vaccinated. That's the best way to prevent variants that can evade the immune response or the protective effect of the vaccines. the best way to prevent them from developing. In terms of, you know, is COVAX going to be the one and only solution? No. COVAX has said that their goal is really to try to get 20% of the eligible population vaccinated by the end of this year. We need more than that. COVAX also, unfortunately, has a huge funding shortfall of, over $27 billion. And it may sound like a lot, but it pales in comparison to the amount that advanced economies like the U.S. would lose if we continue with this inequitable vaccine rollout across the world. What I mean by that, there's been studies by International Chamber of Commerce, Rand Institute, et cetera, that have estimated up to, $4, $5, maybe even $9 trillion in economic losses, and half of that being borne by advanced economies like the U.S., even if we get our whole population vaccinated, because of the drag on the global economy continuing COVID around the world would represent. So I think there's a strong moral humanitarian argument for making sure we do more to get more vaccine into more arms outside of this country. There is a strong public health argument because, getting more people vaccinated around the world prevents the development of these variants, which can undermine our protective vaccine strategy, the protective effective vaccines. And there's also a really strong economic argument. And I think that needs to be brought back to the U.S., to other wealthy countries who to date have contracts for more vaccines than they have even for people who are eligible to receive a vaccine, and think about how we don't not only concentrate on our equitable distribution here in the U.S., which has been problematic, but how we concentrate on that as well globally.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Craig Spencer. He's the Director of Global Health and Emergency Medicine at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center. He's also the Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine and Population and Family Health at Columbia University Medical Center. Learn more about his work and access his writing on the pandemic by going to craigaspencer@medium.com or follow him on Twitter at craigaspencer. Dr. Spencer, we want to thank you for joining us today on Conversation on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Margaret Mark. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Craig Spencer in a Conversations on Healthcare podcast with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. You can find their healthcare discussions at chcradio.com. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hi, I'm Tom Brousseau. March along to some different beats on the next Great American Folk Show. His music is old school soul, but with a contemporary power, you're going to love Quinn DeVoe. Enjoy some old-timey string music from Clinton Davis.
Curly-headed woman was the cause of it all. Tell me how long.
Feel the familial warmth of mother-daughter duo Nina and Teresa Ricci.
All the crown jewels in my glass loop will magnify the light, and I can't wait till I get the glitter in
the sultry,
eye.
Jazzy blues of Sarah Moreau.
Nothing but blue sky.
Plus, singer-songwriter and author Michael Patrick F. Smith sings and reads from his debut book, The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown.
I can drive a truck, swing a sledgehammer. I got two good hands I'm gonna put on to you.
On the Great American Folk Show, Sunday, March 7th at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 23rd. If you have an ear for lively music, you know the almost magnetic attraction of ragtime. It has syncopation, it has energy, it has offbeat notes, and a solid bass line. Ragtime is distinctively American, originating in African American culture. It gets its name from being in ragged time, with syncopated offbeats, and it was about the most popular type of music in America by the early 1900s. Modern-day music aficionados know that Scott Joplin's ragtime tunes included Maple Leaf Rag and The Entertainer.
Joplin had studied classical music, and he masterfully mixed elements of classical harmonies with African-American rhythms and melodies. Ragtime came to North Dakota as early as 1900, when a traveling music company played at Dickinson's Opera House in February. In April, a troupe of black musicians from Chicago brought ragtime to the Williston Opera House, and that October, Wahpeton's Opera House hosted a group playing the hottest ragtime song hits of the day. Although ragtime was an extremely popular fad, not everyone loved it. On this date in 1905, the newspaper in Hope published a short article questioning ragtime's worthiness in comparison with classical music. If classical music served as a tonic to soothe the soul, would offbeat ragtime tunes bring too much excitement? Yet if music was medicine, ragtime might bring downcast souls out of melancholy moods. Still, critics said ragtime put the sin in syncopation. Despite qualms, ragtime gained traction in the state. More people bought pianos, Victor record players, and ragtime sheet music. A 1906 record player ad admitted that musical tastes differ. You may choose ragtime, something classical, or another selection. Yet the Victor machine could play them all. In 1911, composer Irving Berlin wrote one of America's most popular songs, Alexander's Ragtime Band. If you have heard the words, "Come on in here, come on in here, Alexander's Ragtime Band," you find it unforgettable. It may have been the theme song of a generation, reviving the ragtime craze of a decade earlier. Songsters sang it everywhere. Piano players plunked it out everywhere. And music lovers loved it when a small town in McKenzie County, Alexander, formed a new musical organization. They called themselves Alexander's Ragtime Band. What else? Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Some estimates say more than 1 million renters have faced eviction during the pandemic, despite a moratorium, and they are disproportionately black and brown.
Black individuals make up about 21% of all renters, but they make up 35% of all defendants on eviction cases.
Why many still need help despite trillions in federal aid, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, we'll hear about the Little Mo Writers Incubator Project. It's an intensive writing workshop and class that aims to bring a nonfiction research project about North Dakota or bordering regions to life. And so we'll talk about writing and reading with Sue Skaliski, Program Coordinator with Humanities North Dakota. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.